Tervetuloa kaikki. John Crawford on tänään meillä täällä vieraana meidän digitaalisen digiterveyden hankkeen tiimoilta ja ollaan erittäin iloisia, että teitä on tullut tänne näin laaja joukko suhteellisen lyhyellä varoitusajalla paikalle. Ja John on luvannut tänään kertoa meille vähän tarkemmin digihealth-alan trendeistä. Ja John, niin kuin näkyykin, John on healthcare industry leader IBM:ssä ja nähdään ja kuullaan tänään sitten nimenomaan tämmöisiä tämän hetken trendejä. So, please John, we are so happy to have you here and you can share your knowledge to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, can you hear me all right? Well, good, thank you. Thank you. Get some water. So thank you for inviting me to come and talk to you today, and thank you for making the time late on a Wednesday afternoon to come and hear me. As you heard, I'm IBM's healthcare industry leader. I'm based out of London, but I get to see a lot of different healthcare systems around Europe and get to see how they're developing and changing over time. The other thing that I do, which is not on here, is I'm also at the moment the president of the European Health Telematics Association. It's a Brussels-based membership organization, which consists of e-health competence centers from European countries, industry, academia. And in fact, one of my board members is Päivi Hämäläinen, who is from the Finnish Institute for Health here in Finland. I also am on the board of HIMSS, which you may have heard of as one of the major forces in the development of e-health and electronic patient records. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about technology, a little bit about healthcare and medicine, and a little bit about social care. And I'm going to do it in what I hope you'll find is a kind of entertaining way, because these things can be terribly boring if you don't put a little bit of entertainment into them. So I'm going to do it by making some predictions. And as you know, it's really hard to make predictions, especially if you're an expert. If you're an expert, you're going to make the wrong predictions quite often because you're just too deeply involved in the whole industry. And I want to show you some examples of that. I don't know whether you've read the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. A few people have read it. Yeah, so in this book, which is a wonderful book about how we think, how we perceive, how we make decisions, there's a few chapters in that book about predictions. And one of the things that Daniel Kahneman makes clear is that although experts are very good at predicting the direction of travel, predicting how things are going to evolve, they're not very good at predicting the magnitude or the timing of these things. And this is one of the real challenges, I think, for all of us working in health and social care, is we can see what needs to be done, we can understand how technology can really help, but knowing when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, to what extent it's going to happen, is much more difficult to put your finger on. So I'm going to make 7 predictions this evening. I'm not going to predict exactly when they're going to happen, but I'm going to make my planning horizon about 10 years. So I'm going to say from between now and 2027, I'd expect all of the predictions to come true to a reasonable extent. Now, I want to begin by showing you just how hard it is to get this right if you're an expert, by showing you 4 quite well-known predictions that were made by people in the technology business. So let's start with the one on the top. Computers in the future may weigh no more than 1.5 tons. This was 1949, Popular Mechanics. Now, was that a good prediction? Well, actually, it was quite a good prediction, really. It seems ridiculous to us now to think of that, but in those days, the typical computers that they were building weighed 10 tons. Right, and they occupied several rooms, and they used valves and wiring looms and all kinds of electromechanical technology. And so from their point of view, it was quite feasible to think we can reduce the size of this to something more manageable. What they couldn't have predicted, because they weren't really thinking that far ahead, was just how far can we take it? It wasn't really until Shockley invented the transistor in the 1950s that we started to understand the potential to reduce the size of computers to something initially quite a lot smaller. And then with integrated circuits and our nanotechnology, we can take it to extreme miniaturization. So, it was a moving in the right direction. It was the right kind of trajectory, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't a really accurate prediction. The second one, there's no reason why anyone would want a computer in their home. Now, does anybody in this audience not have a computer in their home? Okay, whether you think you do or not, of course, you almost certainly do if you have a television or a mobile phone, a washing machine, a fridge. You've got a microprocessor somewhere in your house. Probably most of us have many dozens of microprocessors operating in our homes. This was said by Ken Olson, who some of you may remember was the founder of Digital Deck, as they were called, a company that was later acquired, I think, by HP. At the time, they were very, very successful. I mean, this was 1977. They were making mini computers. And Ken Olson, again, if he'd been thinking in a futuristic way, could have thought, well, actually, there must be applications for this. But again, think of what computers were like in those days. Anybody around in the 1970s that used computers? Punch cards, tapes, yeah, a few people. I mean, they were difficult things to use. They were expensive. They use a lot of power. Most of them you couldn't interact with through a screen. You had to use, paper to interact with them, punch cards and big printers to produce lots of green flow paper. It was only, towards the end of the 70s it became normal to start using, cathode ray tube screens to interact with computers. And so really, again, it was a question of context. Ken Olson just couldn't really see how he'd take the things he was manufacturing successfully for business and transform them into something that could be used in the home environment. Bill Gates, 640K of memory ought to be enough for anybody. Well, that's, well know Bill Gates, started Microsoft. 1981, he's alleged to have said this. And then the last one, I think there's a world market for maybe five computers. Thomas Watson, the founder of IBM, 1943. Interesting thing is the last two things are completely wrong. The predictions that you'll find if you Google these things, but they were never said. It's kind of interesting that this is a good example of fake news. I think we all hear a lot about fake news at the moment. But actually, this was never said. There's no record of Bill Gates ever having said that this is enough. I mean, I guess what people were reflecting at the time was, well, memory is so expensive, and it really was expensive, that it was hard to imagine that we'd ever get to the point where memory would be almost free, completely free, as we see it today, practically speaking. Thomas Watson did actually talk to customers in just around about this time in the early 1940s when we were thinking of getting into the first electronic digital computers, not digital, but electronic computers. And he assessed that only about five companies actually were capable of, first of all, affording and secondly, running one of these things because, again, the whole technology was completely different. So quite difficult if you're in the middle of a technology revolution in a way to kind of really predict accurately the future, even if you get the direction right. Let's take a look at some from other industries now. First one, the telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. This was one of the, at the time, telegraphy companies, Western Union, 1876. And again, think about this, telephones were not very good in those days, but they got better. They got to the point where they were actually viable and enough people had them for them to be realistically considered as a common means of communication. And the second one, the wireless music box has no imaginable commercial value. Who would pay for a message to be sent to nobody in particular? And what they're talking about here is radio, the idea of putting a microphone in front of a person or in front of an orchestra and then just broadcasting it into the air. This was David Sarnoff, who was trying to persuade his company to invest in radio, and they were basically saying, it sounds like a nice idea, but how do we make any money out of it if we're just kind of sending it out into the ether and people can just receive it? And in fact, he did some very clever things to get his company to take this seriously in the end, which involved broadcasting music and building a model around it, which made sense. Now, the interesting thing about these two predictions, if you take these two things that were said and then put them together, the idea of telephony and wireless networks, we have the trillion-dollar industry today, that is the mobile phone industry. So it's interesting how some of these ideas, they take time to evolve. Often it takes time for people to understand what the implication of it is, but we get there in the end. I want to finally show you something that was very interesting. It was said by the guy who used to run the U.S. Patent Office, Charles Duell. Patent Office is where all the U.S. patent applications have to be lodged. And you can see here what he says. In my opinion, all previous advances in the various lines of invention will appear totally insignificant when compared with those which the present century will witness. I almost wish that I might live my life over again to see the wonders which are at the threshold. When do you think he said this? Any ideas? I shall tell you. He said it in 1902. Now, just think about that. Think about the incredible technological progress that was made between 1902 and the end of the last century. You know, the progress made in flight, the progress made in mechanics and electronics and science generally. Now, you could equally well say the same thing now about the century that we're looking at ahead, because of the technological rate of change is speeding up. It's not slowing down, it's actually accelerating. And we now have technologies in our hands that we couldn't possibly have conceived of 20 or 30 years ago. And when we look at industries and how they're changing through the use of technology, in IBM, we tend to talk about four, there are many more, but four drivers of technological change, and here they are. And you'll recognize all of these, I'm sure. Going in a clockwise movement from the top, the mobile revolution, we're all very aware of the fact that, and especially in Finland, that this is something which has really transformed the way that we access services, the way that we get information, the way that we navigate. I mean, yesterday on the way here, I used my iPhone a couple of times. I used it to buy a train ticket because I missed my flight connection, I had to get on the train. The ticket machine wasn't working at the station. I thought, I'll just get on the train and I'll ask the conductor what to do. Then I thought, aha, I bet in Finland you can buy tickets through your mobile phone. Of course you can. So within 2 minutes, I had a ticket. And then the inspector came along to look at my ticket. That was fine. I used it to find the restaurant I had to get to when I arrived in the city, using Google Maps to navigate very quickly and effectively there. So we've got this incredible platform, which is mobile, which is pervasive, which almost every human on the planet has access to a mobile phone. And of course, it has these wonderful qualities of immediacy, location awareness, and it's a wonderful platform for innovating new ideas, a very cost-effective platform to get started on. Today, we've been discussing this as part of the workshops that we've been running around the topic of aging. So the mobile revolution is wonderful. Is it in the hands of everybody? Well, there was an interesting article published just a few weeks ago, and one of the contributors was the University of Oulu in Finland, and they were asking the question, is the smartphone really ubiquitous? Does everybody really have a smartphone? Does everybody really use it? Now, they did a survey of many different countries. What they found was that many older people have smartphones. They have them, but they don't use them as smartphones. They use them for voice and for text. So in other words, they're buying quite an expensive device and then just minimizing the functionality of it down to the things that they want to cope with. that's fine. I mean, we all, you know, we all choose what we want to do with the tools that we have access to. And if you don't want to use the phone, or if it's frankly, in my case, I'm finding this too, at my age, difficult to read small text on a smartphone, then you have to find other ways of achieving the same thing. But I think the point about this article, is that we can't assume that older people, just because they have smartphones, that makes it a great device for delivering health and care innovation. It's something we have to think very carefully about, and we might need to think about different form factors for phones. In fact, we already see a trend towards bigger phones anyway. I happen to be carrying, I don't have it, it's around a small iPhone. Some people like the big ones. Some people prefer tablets and iPads and so on. The point is, the mobile revolution is here to stay, and almost every company that I talk to is really focused on making this work for them. You know, we've moved away from desktops, we've moved pretty much away from laptops to a large degree. People are looking at the mobile environment as being the place to innovate in first. The second thing is the Internet of Things. So the idea of having sensors, wearable devices, implantables devices. We all know there are now more things connected to the Internet than humans. That's a good thing. It means we have more data being generated from our environment. But we can also generate data ourselves. And this is one of the more interesting developments in the last 5 years, really, I would say, is the idea that we are now able to buy and consume and use devices that tell us about ourselves, and we can share that knowledge with other people. So, I mean, the most obvious one, which I guess many of us are wearing today, is one of these. It's basically a pacing device. It counts steps, tells the time, reminds me to do things sometimes. Very simple device. And the thing about these is that they seem to have a useful life of maybe 6 months. After that, once you know how many steps you do a day, they kind of lose their interest a little bit. So what do you have to do instead to keep people interested in using these devices? I'm going to come back to this later, so I won't spend too much time on it just now. But just to say that there is a tremendous amount of interest now in the consumer space, especially of developing these, you know, relatively low-cost, affordable, easy-to-use, wearable devices that tell us about ourselves, that can capture signals about what we're doing and how healthy we are, what a healthy lifestyle we may or may not be leading. The third driver is the power of analytics. And I know I'm in the presence of some brilliant mathematicians. I'm looking at one right now. I guess, I'm not a mathematician, I have to say. I wish I'd paid more attention to it when I was at school. I never really understood it well enough to develop a career in it. But I can see that, you know, just using the data, using information, using numbers, to understand the world is just a wonderful capability. We've now got the processing power and the means, the software, to do more and more of it. We can use analytics to deliver deep insight into what the data tells us. We can use it to predict the future in a way, to predict at least health outcomes and health trajectories. And it can make information actionable, and this is the other key thing, that a lot of the data that we've been used to having in our health and care systems has been locked up in individual pieces. You know, some of it's in the medical record, some of it's in the radiology PAC system, some of it's in the lab system, some of it's in a social care record, some of it's in the primary care setting. That data only really becomes very useful when you can make it more liquid and get it moving around the system. So a lot of the focus right now is on getting that data exposed so that we can start to work on it in different ways, using different analytical techniques. One of the more interesting areas in this space is the idea that we should be able to process much more than just much more than structured data. So we need to be able to read language. And, you know, medical information, for example, contains a lot of narrative text. The doctors and nurses write notes about the patient. Computers have not been very good at dealing with that up until now. I mean, you can store it on a computer, but you've got to read it as a human by printing it out or looking on a screen. But we're now developing computer capabilities to allow you to read and understand natural language and to extract knowledge from it and to codify it. We can do the same thing with images, the idea of being able to go in and analyze and look at a medical image and come out with a more accurate assessment of what that image means than a human could. That's a reality today. We can do that today. We showed a very interesting demonstration at the HIMSS conference last year of a device that allows you to take a regular mobile phone, you clip a lens over the existing camera lens. It's a lens in the lighting source. You hold it against a skin lesion. So let's say you've got a spot, as I have on my hand here, and you take a photograph. You then send that off to, in our case, the Watson Health Imaging software, and within a few seconds, you'll get a reply back saying this is completely benign, or it's definitely a malignant melanoma, or it may be either. You have to get more checks done. So the idea of being able to look at an image and to make a medical assessment instantly is very reassuring, and I guess this is one of the things that we can expect these analytical engines to be able to do in the future, to take more of the load of the routine load away from the clinician when it comes to analyzing medical histories, analyzing signals of various kinds, analyzing images. The final thing which is driving a lot of the change is cloud computing, of course. And what does this give? Gives us a low-cost platform. It gives us flexibility. We can scale up and down very fast. And it's very democratizing. So people with a good idea can now develop a fantastic app on an iPhone or an Android and can deploy a service on a cloud platform and do it all in a matter of days and have something up and running. And if it works, we can scale it up. If it doesn't, you start again. I mean, this is a wonderful time to be an innovator in this space because the cost of entering the market has never been lower. The actual success rate, there's a different thing. How well can you do this in the long run? So I want to now turn my attention to what this means for health and social care. And I think there are three kind of things to think about. One is if we use technology effectively in these domains, we can, first of all, transform the ambition, design, and operations of our systems of care. What I mean by that is we can actually repurpose them to make them fit for the future. Our systems of care were actually conceived, in many cases, over 100 years ago to deal with the medical and social problems of that time. And the medical problems were mostly concerned with infectious disease, and the social problems were concerned with extreme poverty and extreme deprivation. Now, we're in a different world today, thank goodness. The focus has moved from infectious to non-communicable diseases, you know, lifestyle-acquired diseases, if you like, and also the things that come with age, such as dementia and cancer. And the social care systems are now looking at trying to equalize access for people to give people a dignified quality of life. So let's use technology to achieve some of these ambitions. Because our systems of care have to change. They are all unsustainable. I've not found any health and social care system so far that, to me, looks sustainable in the long run. You can fix them in the short run, but they all need to be changed, and they all need to be adapted, and they all need to use technology in a new way to help them to achieve this. The second thing is we can use technology to give us all more control of our own health, well-being, and aging. And again, this goes back to the idea that we can learn about ourselves, we can use technology to motivate us in a variety of ways, to think about our health a bit more often, to understand what keeps us well, what makes us sick, and we can be more self-sufficient if we want to be. Again, this is not for everybody. For many people, this is something they'll want to do. And finally, we can use all classes of data, as I've mentioned, all kinds of data, to make care more personalized, effective, and safe. And here I'm thinking primarily about the idea of much more personalized medicine, you know, using information about our medical history, but also genomic data and lifestyle data to try and make the whole thing more personalized. But also we can use data to understand where there are safety risks in the healthcare system. You know, where is there unwarranted variation? You know, where are people not doing well after heart operations? Where are people being given the wrong initial treatment for cancer? We can use the data to understand this in the system and then to correct it before it becomes a big problem. So lots of potential there. And I think in Finland, you're very fortunate because you have a tremendous history of collecting good data here. And this is one of the reasons why IBM is so excited to be working with TechEs and with the Finnish government, because you are one of the few countries that I think can really take advantage of some of these ideas right now without having to do too much more work. Let's talk about the predictions then. Seven predictions, I'm going to go through them fairly quickly. So my first prediction is pretty straightforward. It's that care systems will use data to proactively manage population and individual health risks. And we give this the overall name population health management. It's becoming much better understood now as a concept. And the concept really is this, that if you think of a typical healthcare system, the people that use it are the ones who show up, right? So you decide you don't feel well, you make an appointment, you go and see your primary care doctor, does some examinations on you, maybe sends you for some tests, maybe refers you to a specialist, and so on. But the point is that you've decided that you are unwell, so you're going to use the system. There are many people that just don't do that. They don't actually come into the medical system until there's a crisis. They have a stroke, or they have a fall, or they have some other thing that causes an emergency to happen. Now, we know if you look at any given population, let's say you're looking at a small town. I don't know, what's the population of Jyväskylä? Is it 150,000 or more? How many people live here?
A bit less. 136,000.
Okay, but 136,000 people. So if I took the whole population of Jyväskylä, I could analyze everybody. If I had access to the records, I could analyze everybody in the city and say, I'm going to place you somewhere along this axis, because this is our health journey here. So in a typical population, you'll find that most of the people in a population are going to be towards the left-hand side of this health journey. The health journey starts with when we're born. If we're fortunate, we'll be healthy. We'll have very low health risks. Over time, damage accumulates to us, you know, whether it's through inactivity, overeating, smoking, alcohol, whatever it may be, we start to get damaged by life, and we move along this health journey towards the right-hand side. And as you move towards the right, of course, you're getting into more and more expensive interventions. You're getting into the really expensive part of the healthcare system, including, you know, hospitals, including surgery, including cancer treatment, and so on, end of life, if you like. So the idea really of population health is to say we shouldn't be waiting to see who shows up. We should be looking at everybody's health journey all the time. We should be using technology to understand where are people. So, for example, in Jyväskylä, if there are, let's say, 80,000 people in that healthy low-risk category, which that may be a reasonable guess, I don't know, then we should not be too worried about those people, but we should be reminding them about the health risks that they perhaps are running. We should be educating. We should be telling them about how to avoid problems in the future, keeping them healthy as long as possible. This is the job of public health. And in any given healthcare system, public health only consumes a fraction of a percent of the budget, which is also quite scary. Most of the budget goes on fixing people rather than, you know, stopping them getting sick in the first place. The point about this technology that we can put in place here is that we can start to outreach to people automatically using their own preferred means of communication. We can use Facebook, we can use text, we can use email, whatever people feel they're going to respond to. So once you've categorized people into that, you can then start to work with them in a particular way. People in the at-risk and high-risk categories, and that may be, I don't know, 10 or 20,000 people in this town, they're people who maybe aren't symptomatic yet, but definitely are on the way to getting hypertension, or on the way to being overweight, or on the way to having some, some lung-related problem, you know, asthma or COPD. Again, what you want to do here is basically work with them in a slightly different way. You want to start bringing them in for screening, for example. Screening programs are quite common in many countries now, especially for things like breast and bowel cancer. The idea of this is basically, you can start to use predictive modeling algorithms in here to say, okay, if we look at this population, maybe there's 10 or 20,000, but there's only about 500 that we really want to worry about right now, because these are the people. If we catch them now, then we avoid them slipping towards the right-hand side of this diagram. And then when you get into the right-hand side, You've got people, and I don't know how many, I wouldn't like to guess really in this time, but you've got people who are diagnosed, they have a condition, they're having to manage it, they often need help, or they may be going towards the end of life, in which case you're into palliative care and so on. So what I'm really saying here is that we need technology, and we have it, we need to start using it, which allows us not just to wait to see who shows up, but to actually keep looking at the data. This is really mostly at primary care, so it's about using the primary care records that we have, and it's about engaging the population in their health journey at all times. So there should be no surprises. We should know what to expect from a population. We should know where the health risks are. From the point of view of a health system payer, and I guess that's your local government here, would that be right? It's the local government who pays for your healthcare costs, or the national government in Finland? Who pays for your health? Local, yeah. So from that point of view, this would be wonderful because they could then understand for the first time, where are the health risks in the population? Where are they? When are they going to show up? You know, what can we do to hold the tide back? So the payers love it. And if you're an accountable care organization, as we now have in the United States, this is essential because you're managing risk. You're not just managing people coming in and you know, having them pay every time you do something to them. This is about really managing a pool of risk. From the point of view of individuals, I think it's a great thing because it means that people are going to feel that somebody is interested in their health journey and they're not just on their own. So I predict that this is going to be something which every care system will start to think about, will start to do something about, but it requires that we get the data and work with it in a new way. The second prediction I'm going to make is that we'll see more integrated care, and it will be delivered by multidisciplinary teams, including the patients themselves, with real-time shared care plans. Now, one of the disadvantages of getting older is that we become more complex patients. It's just a fact of life that as we age, as each year goes by, we have more and more chance of accumulating multiple conditions, and that in itself is okay. We can manage that. We can, you know, we can take pills for blood pressure. We can take pills for cholesterol. We can take pills to manage all kinds of things. But when you start putting them together, that's when it becomes a little bit complicated. If you're dealing with a patient that maybe has 7, 8, or 9 simultaneous conditions, let's say some cognitive decline, early stage dementia, COPD, hypertension, frailty, then you're dealing with people that really need a lot more attention. And when some countries have looked at where all their healthcare spending is going, what they're finding is quite surprising to them. Scotland did this recently. Now, Scotland's got the same size population as Finland, about 5 million people. And they looked at where their health spending went. And it's a well-known kind of axiom in healthcare circles that, you know, it's the old Pareto principle that 20% of your population use 80% of your resources. Now, what Scotland found was that actually in a population of 5 million, 100,000 people were using 60% of the resources, right? So that's like, it's like about 2% of the population use 60%. Now, why is that? Well, there's some very good reasons for why some of them are overusing it. Some of them are end of life and they're going to be expensive because they're intensively being looked after. That's fine, but that's what a civilized society should do. Some of them have disabilities or they may have really hard to treat chronic problems which require a lot of ongoing nursing care. But many of the people in that category are expensive because they're in and out of hospital all the time. They're basically not being properly managed and they don't have the resources to manage themselves. Effectively. So these are people that have just been bounced in and out of hospital, social care, primary care. So with that group of patients, and we need to identify them using the kind of tools I've been suggesting earlier, we need to have integrated care, by which I mean not just really good communications between primary and secondary care and really good contact between medical care and social care, but also we need to have the tools for these people to use to do their job. And today, there are not many good examples that I've seen so far of countries that are using shared care plans where you sit down and say, okay, here's a really complex individual who is just going to become more and more dependent on care services. Let's work out a plan for them, and let's keep that plan up to date by sharing it and by making sure that it's actually delivering the results we expect. This needs to happen. You know, this is, you've seen for yourself the Pareto Principle 2080 rule, but also the Scotland 260 rule, suggests that if you focus a lot of your attention on the people that are the high demand people in your care systems and the ones who are just about to become high demand, because we should know who those are too, then that's one of the best ways to release resources and to get basically more, your money working more for the whole population rather than just a fraction of it. The alternative to doing this is we end up spending more and more on the complex patients, we have less and less for everybody else, and we start rationing, and this is what we're seeing in a few countries now. So, shared care plans, care teams, we need technology to allow this to happen. This is really about communicating a plan, and again, there are some countries doing some interesting work here. One that I've been very closely involved with is Denmark. The region of South Denmark has built such a shared care system. They've been piloting it. They're now going to scale it up. We're doing something very similar in the region of Catalonia in Spain, where, again, we're using a slightly different technology. But the aim is the same. Let's create the plan, let's share it, and let's make sure that it's being used by the entire care team. So, third prediction. Each of us will be engaged across the life course as owners and co-creators of our own health. Now, we did a little study a few years ago now where we asked the question, you know, what kind of things are people using applications and wearables for? You know, where does their interest lie? And we came up with kind of three mega categories, if you like. On the left-hand side, you've got the motivated healthy. So these are people who are either athletes, you know, sportsmen, or people like me who just want to keep in good shape as much as possible. And we're really focused on just using technology to maintain our health, fitness, and wellness. That's great. We need that, but that's a relatively small fraction of the population. On the right-hand side, you've got people who are living with serious, often life-threatening conditions, who are being monitored on a fairly continuous basis. People with heart failure, people with COPD, people with other life-threatening conditions that you can apply some technology to just make sure we're not going out of the safe limits of acceptability. But in the middle, we've got this huge category of people, and it's probably most of us, who are just information seekers. You know, we don't want to be super fit. We don't want to run, 30,000 steps a day. We're not sick enough to be monitored, but we do want to know more about what keeps us well. And therefore, there's a kind of a hunger here for things that are useful to us. Not just things that tell us we've done 10,000 steps, but things that actually give us biofeedback. And there's a huge amount of innovation going on here right now. Many of you may have heard of the quantified self movement. This is a group of people who are just seeing how far they can push this idea. They're basically monitoring everything about themselves, what they eat, how well they sleep, how many steps they do, how often they go swimming, how their digestion is. They're monitoring everything about themselves they possibly can, just to kind of, in a way, show what the limits of this thing might be. But again, that's not the usual situation. Mostly, we're looking at people that just want to know a bit more about how they might improve their fitness by reminding them to do the right things at the right time, by making time for exercise. And, the more I look into the causes of poor health, the more I realize that inactivity has to be one of the most significant things. In fact, sitting has been called the new smoking. Have you heard that expression? Sitting is the new smoking. You know, sitting down for 8 or 9 hours a day at a desk is just as harmful as smoking several cigarettes on your health status in terms of the effect that has on your cardiovascular system and on your general levels of fitness. So just moving around is important. So anything that helps you to remember that and to make time to be active is important. But it's not just about physical health, and I want to show you a couple of innovations that I had the chance to use last year. There's two products here which I think kind of show the way that things might develop into the future, because mental health and physical health are not inseparable. They're actually quite closely connected. People who are ill tend to have mental health issues like depression. People who are depressed and anxious often have somatic issues that arise because of their mood. So what can we do on the mental health side? Well, the top device is a thing called the Muse, and what it is a consumer-grade and consumer-priced electroencephalograph, an EEG. It measures brain activity. You wear it like a pair of sunglasses. You can see the woman here wearing it just over her ears. It goes right across the front of your brow. It has sensors all the way around. And it's basically measuring brain waves. That's what it's looking for, particular brainwave patterns. The way you use it is that you put it on, and it then connects to your telephone through Bluetooth, and it takes the raw signal, processes it on the phone, and turns it into a soundscape, which you then listen to through your headphones. So you can hear your brain working. It's kind of quite spooky when you first put it on, because the soundscape can vary. It can be, you can be in a forest, tropical rainforest. You can be sitting on a beach. You can be in a desert. And it creates that soundscape. And the more active and distracted your brain is, the more noisy the soundscape is. So if you're sitting on the beach, you get all this wind noise and the sea crashing and so on. The idea is you meditate. It's very simple meditation. Just focus on your breathing. And as you meditate, you can actually hear the soundscape changing in your head. And the more successful your meditation, the more you kind of reduce your level of stress and distraction, the gentler the sounds become. And eventually you hear birdsong. And one of the great things about this application is it kind of makes you want to hear birdsong all the time. Has anybody used the Muse? I didn't ask. Has anybody? No. Okay, so take a look at it. It's quite interesting. The birdsong is like a reward. It's basically giving you a reward for being successful. And at the end of your meditation, which might last 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, you get a readout of how well you did. And it will say you were relaxed for 8 minutes. That's good. So all the way through this whole intervention, you're basically using this device to improve your mental state. Very interesting idea. Not being sold as a medical device, it's being sold as a meditation aid. And I think it does work. It's got me back into meditation after not doing it for 35 years. The second device is rather interesting. It's called the Spire. Anybody use the Spire? Okay. What is it? Well, it's basically, it doesn't show you here, but it's basically a respiration monitor. You clip it on your belt. If you're a woman, you can clip it on a bra if you're wearing a skirt instead or a dress. And it measures the movements of your chest cavity, essentially. And what's it looking for? It's basically trying to, again, look for patterns. Now, depending on what you're doing, your respiration will vary quite a lot. If you're walking around, it's difficult to measure respiration. So when you're walking around, this turns into an accelerometer. It measures steps. But when you're not walking around, which is what I said, most of us are sitting around a lot these days, it monitors your breathing, and it puts you into one of four categories. It says you are focused, so your breathing rate is slightly higher than normal, but still regular. Or you're calm, your breathing rate's lower than normal and also regular. Or you're tense, your breathing rate is higher than normal and very erratic. Or you're just neutral, you're just in none of these states. The interesting thing about this device is it basically has a feedback mechanism. So if you're getting tense, like I've been sitting looking at an email that I don't like for 10 minutes and deciding what to write, I might get this thing buzzing on my belt saying, John, you've been tense for 10 minutes, it's time to get up and take a walk. Right? And the great thing about it is at the end of the day, you can look back at what's been happening throughout your day, and you can see the patterns of where you were calm, focused, tense, and how long you spent in each state. Why is this important? Again, it's just giving us the chance to take information about ourselves and turn it into immediate action. We can do something about it. We can reduce our levels of stress. So some interesting ideas coming through. The fourth prediction is that the Internet of Things will enable smart homes, advanced telemetry, so using technology to keep people safe, and robotics to support aging in place. These are a few of the examples that we've been looking at very closely. The top left-hand three pictures are the Abitari Sekuri project in Bolzano. I showed a video about this earlier in the session we were in. And this is a project to basically see if we can put technology into people's homes, older people's homes, often living alone, which is non-intrusive, so we can basically make sure they're doing okay. So rather than people having to go and use devices or switch things on and off, we hide the technology in the home. We can use very unobtrusive things like measuring energy to see when the television was switched on and off, to see when the cooker was switched on. We can use CO2 in the air as a proxy for activity. So if the CO2 levels have not been going up, we know that someone's not been moving around very much, and so forth. And the idea of all of this is to basically monitor the activities of daily living and make sure people are doing all right in their own homes to head off crises that may occur. The top right-hand two pictures are of telemedicine, telehealth, the idea, which is quite well accepted now, that increasingly we should be using the devices in our own homes to communicate with doctors and with nurses. And it's entirely viable. I have a number of friends in the medical profession who are so frustrated that they want to do this. They want to talk to their patients using Skype or using FaceTime, but not allowed to because of security issues or worries about privacy. This will come. This needs to come because this is all about giving people convenience and choice when it comes to medical appointments. We should not insist that people have to go and see the doctor. That model is last century's model. We need a model for this century, and this is really about remote access. The robotics thing, this is Pepper, the robot here. Pepper's a child-sized robot. It's what's called an affective or an emotional robot. Essentially, it can look at you and assess what kind of mood you're in, assess what kind of health status you're in. Using cameras in its eyes, it can listen for problems, it can listen for sounds which are unusual around the house. We're working with a university in Texas to see whether we can turn this into a useful companion in a way, a useful safety companion for older people who may want to live independently but can't afford a permanent carer to live with them. Can we repurpose a robot to do this kind of thing? And behind this, we're putting the power of cognitive computing, which I'll come back to in a moment, the power of cognitive computing to make this personalized and interactive to the individual. And then we've got other robots like Robear here that can carry people, can support them as they move around the house if they have those needs. Incidentally, I was told that's not a very good way to carry someone who's disabled. I think we need to look into better ways of lifting people than that. My fifth prediction is that health data will be liberated and put to work for our benefit. This goes back to what I said at the start, that the health data is everywhere. We need to bring it together. We need to aggregate it. That does not mean one big database. I'm not talking about putting everything into one massive database. But we need to find ways of linking data and normalizing it and getting more value out of it than we have seen so far. Most medical data is collected for the purpose of diagnosis and treatment. Most social care data is collected for the purpose of commissioning services and following up. What we have to start thinking about is how do we repurpose that data in a meaningful way so that we can understand more about individual needs and customize what we're doing for them much more completely. So we can use this to do other things. We can liberate data to feed into medical research. Medical researchers are always struggling to get the data that they need to do their studies. Real-world evidence. The pharmaceutical industry wants to know how the drug that they developed and tested on a 20-year-old student is working on a 60-year-old woman with COPD. You know, they want to know this. They want to know that these things are actually effective. So getting feedback and consolidating that is essential if we're going to have real-world evidence used in our healthcare systems. Precision medicine, obviously, the idea of understanding so much about an individual down to the genomic level that we can precisely target cancer treatment. This is going to be really, really one of the big revolutions, I would say, in the next decade, the idea of genomic medicine starting to have an impact. And then we can use the data about how the healthcare system is working in terms of costs and outcomes to improve how the system operates. So lots to do with data. And in fact, data has been recognized as having real economic value. This was the World Economic Forum report 2011. They were talking not just about medical data, but about all kinds of personal data, saying that really this is an asset. It's an asset class. And countries that have generated data should be using this and thinking of it almost like oil or gold. It's in the same kind of class. It has value, but you have to mine it, refine it, and expose it. You have to start working with it and putting it into use. And I think Finland in particular is sitting on a real gold mine of wonderful historical information about the population. My second to last prediction is that new services will be created to meet the demands of an older population. And this is one I just want to pick out. I mean, there's many examples of new services. This is one that I particularly like. It's called Call and Check, and it's being used in a little island off the south coast of England called Jersey. They have a postal service, and the postal service is going out of business because they employ all these postmen to walk around the streets every single day except weekends and deliver letters. And the letters are going down and down, so they have less and less mail to deliver. Amazon are using other carriers very often, DHL and FedEx and so on, to deliver parcels. So the postman is going out of business. So what can be done? Well, there's a solution here that helps them and helps the community. As they're going around the streets anyway, why not pay the postal workers to ring on the doorbell of certain people who've nominated themselves and just to ask how they're doing? You know, just have a conversation. So instead of delivering a letter, you deliver a conversation. And the conversation they deliver here is basically just five questions. It's to do with, how are you feeling? Do you have enough medication? Do you have enough to eat? Is there anything that you need when I come back tomorrow? Can I take any messages for you to your doctor, to your social care worker, and so on? And as they're doing this, the postal worker, who's not a healthcare worker, they can still be looking at the individual and thinking, well, this person looks confused, or this person looks depressed, or they haven't dressed yet, and it's 5 o'clock, you know. So there are things that can be relayed back to the individuals that worry about these people who are often very vulnerable living on their own. And I think we need to start really considering how we use these existing assets that we have today, which might disappear if we don't repurpose them, to deliver better care. Because a lot of the people that end up in these hospital emergency rooms or in ambulances, they're not there because they want to be there. They're there because they just can't cope on their own. And they have a crisis, and the next thing you know, they're calling the ambulance, or someone's calling the ambulance for them. So if we can just keep people more supported through these more informal networks of care, that's a good thing. And I think there'll be a lot more innovation to come. The last thing I want to talk about is something which will be no surprise to you if you've been following IBM's work in this space, which is that machine learning, artificial intelligence, and cognitive computing will support the development of personalized healthcare and precision medicine. Now, many of you will know about the Watson Project. This was really essentially an IBM research idea that we had to see if we could develop a computer that could understand human knowledge and answer questions about it. So we set ourselves a very high challenge here. We'd already, 20 years before this, worked on the problem of chess with the Deep Blue computer. So we designed a computer that could play chess so well that it could beat the reigning grandmaster Garry Kasparov. It took about a year for us to do that, to beat him finally, but we did beat the champion. But chess is a very simplistic thing to program a computer to do, because there's a defined number of moves. There's many permutations, but it's a very well-bounded problem domain. General knowledge, general human knowledge, is not. It covers everything. So we had to, in order to take on this challenge, we had to think about what's the best way to demonstrate that we can do it. So we decided to put Watson, the computer, on a live game show called Jeopardy. This is a show where basically the question master gives an answer to a question and says, what was the question? So if I say to you something like, he sang on Yellow Submarine, what answer would you give to that? He sang on Yellow Submarine. Who are the Beatles fans here? Ringo. Ringo's the answer. Ringo Starr. So in order for you to get that to that result, you'd have to know a bit about popular culture. You'd have to know who the Beatles were. You'd have to know that Ringo didn't sing on very many tracks, but Yellow Submarine was one of them that he did, memorably. You've got to understand nuance and ambiguity in the language. And you've also got to have the whole of human knowledge at your fingertips. So we basically designed a system that we could essentially load up with all this knowledge. And that was the original Watson system. So long story short, we went on live television. We did beat the two reigning champions at Jeopardy. This is them, Ken Jennings and on the left. I forget the chap on the right, I'm afraid. But they were the reigning champions. And we won, and we gave the money to charity. And so we developed something that could understand human knowledge. So what do we do with that? So we immediately started thinking about other domains. And one of the first that came to mind was medicine. So what are the three things that Watson does really well? Well, the first thing is that it understands natural language. And this is true for many artificial intelligence systems. So because these systems can understand language and understand how to interpret language, you can get into a dialogue with them. You can interact with them in a natural way. Rather than typing in, you know, codes and so on, you can actually converse with them. The second thing they do is they can generate and evaluate hypotheses. They can look at evidence to support hypotheses. So when I ask Watson a question, the first thing it does after understanding what the question means is it will then start assembling all the possible answers. And the more hypotheses it generates, the better. So Watson will generate thousands of hypotheses to the question. And then it will look for evidence to support the hypotheses. And only the ones that have sufficient evidence will get to the top of the list. Now, Watson never comes back with a single answer. It always comes back with a confidence ranking of multiple answers. That's very important. Again, if you think of medicine, this is how doctors work. The idea of differential diagnosis. You basically are looking to eliminate all the possibilities that are unlikely and to maximize the ones that are likely. And then you start looking for further evidence to support your top hypothesis. So it's really good from that point of view. It plugs right into the medical diagnostic model. And finally, it adapts and learns. It's a machine learning system. So over time, it gets better and better at doing this. So when Watson first started working on medical problems, it was really bad. I mean, it was just hopeless. We had to train it. And that's the point. These are not program systems. You don't sit down and program all the possible things. You train it. And you train it to get better and better at what it does. Watson uses a whole series of subsystems to do what it does. It's not just a single algorithm. And it chooses different subsystems depending on where it's getting most success. And as over time, as it improves and learns, it's basically choosing different strategies to answer the question. Now, we trained Watson intensively in oncology. This is the first place that we thought we should try and target. Why? Because oncology is a difficult medical discipline. We focus mostly on treatment rather than diagnostics, because usually by the time you're diagnosed with cancer, you know, it's usually fairly obvious, you know, what the diagnosis is. What's not obvious is what do I do next? What's the best course of treatment? So we focus on the treatment end of this. And we worked with some cancer specialists in the United States, in Memorial Sloan Kettering, a New York hospital, to train Watson to be a great oncologist, and that was the very first thing we did. We've now installed Watson in about 15 places around the world, including some surprising places like India at Menipal Hospital and in Thailand. And the reason it's being picked up in these places is because they do not have the expertise that the people in New York have. They've not got the years of experience of treating complex cancer patients. So this is really about taking expertise and scaling it and making it available to other people. That's really one of the things that Watson does. We've further taken the bits within Watson and broken them out into fragments so that you can use Watson services to enhance existing applications. I'll come back to that in just a moment. People often ask me, are we going to replace doctors with Watson? And my answer today, at least, is no. We still need doctors. We still need people to make the final decision. But I want to show you something which maybe tries to encapsulate, you know, what are the differences between a human and a cognitive system. So we humans are very good at the things along the top, you know, things like what we think of as common sense or having a mental model of the world that works in a way, solving dilemmas, having moral compass, having moral sentiments, compassion, imagination, dreaming, abstraction, generalization. We're all really good at that kind of thing. Cognitive systems, on the other hand, excel at the things along the bottom. They can consume vast amounts of natural language. They can read millions of pages of unstructured text a second and organize them and retrieve them very fast. They can identify patterns better than generally we can in data. They can locate where the knowledge is and retrieve it. They can improve their performance over time. Well, hopefully we do that too, but they do it exceptionally well. They can eliminate bias, and they can also, they have endless capacity. They never get tired. Now, the eliminating bias one, I think, is really, really important for medicine. If I think back to Daniel Kahneman's book again, Thinking Fast and Slow, one of the things that happens a lot in medicine is that doctors are trained to use what's called system one, which means they're trained to look at what's in front of them, look at the evidence that's available, and make intuitive, instant decisions about what this is likely to be. That works a lot of the time, right? But sometimes it really doesn't work, and you end up with a completely wrong diagnosis or a wrong treatment plan. It's very difficult for doctors to go back to system two, which requires you to make a lot more mental effort. So if system one is about jumping to a conclusion, system two is about sitting back and spending hours to look at all the evidence and then assessing what this means, coming out with hopefully a better answer. So what's the relationship between doctor and Watson? Well, the doctor would deal with all the routine issues. They would deal with the human interaction. They may turn to Watson in order to say, I think this is what is going on here, but what do you think? Give me some system two answers here, and I want them really fast. So the idea of the partnership here is that we can put together the human qualities of the doctor in interacting with the patient, and then the cognitive analytical capabilities of the Watson system, and hopefully that combination, you end up with a better decision, because this is really about decision making. I'm going to finish in a moment. I just want to show you a couple more things. One of the key things that's come out of the Watson Project is the idea that we can't do it ourselves. You know, we are not, as a company, capable of, and in fact, we don't want to be responsible for all of the things you could do with the Watson. So we very much got into a partnering posture with a lot of companies. And here are some of them that you may be aware of. Medtronic and Novo Nordisk. We're working with both of these companies on diabetes management. We can use cognitive computing to provide a constant feedback loop for people with either type 1 or, in some cases, type 2 diabetes to improve how they're managing their diabetes. So we're combining, if you like, the medication with the intelligence. And this is something the pharma companies are really interested in, pharma and device companies. They can see that if they want their products to work really well, they've got to make them much more customized to individuals. With Johnson & Johnson, they do replacement knee joints. And from time to time, some of us in this room may need a replacement knee joint. When you do that, you want to be able to have an application that coaches the patient in what to do to prepare for surgery. And then after surgery, helps them to get through the physiotherapy and rehabilitation phase. So we're working with J&J, again, on using cognitive technology to make that whole process as easy as possible for the patient. So you end up with a more successful operation. And on the right-hand side, we've got Under Armour, who are in the fitness and wellness space. They produce a range of sports equipment, a bit like Nike. And again, the idea is to work with them on using cognitive technology to motivate and to give higher performance to people that want to really, really improve their physical fitness. You can tap into the Watson ecosystem anytime using a thing called Bluemix. It's a kind of a cloud-based platform. And you can try out some of these Watson services to see if they work for you. We're getting more and more companies that are beginning to, you know, to use this idea of cognitive when they need it, right? So just tapping into this new capability when they need it. So here's my 7 predictions made for the next 10 years. I think that all of them will come true to some extent. As I said right at the outset, I don't think experts, including me, can really predict how fast and exactly when these things will become completely prevalent. Companies like Gartner do the hype cycle. Maybe you know the hype cycle, where they show the evolution of technology as a kind of a wave, where things get invented, they go up to the top of the hype cycle, where they're being overhyped, you know, their expectations are too high, then they fall off into the trough of disillusionment, and then eventually, if they have merit, they come back and they start to come into more general use. And it's seen that many technologies go through this kind of wave cycle. I think when it comes to health and social care, we know what we have to do. We understand a lot of the issues that we're dealing with here. What has been less successful is using technology in innovative ways to change the way that people work within the system, to change the way the system works, to change the way that we access services. And I think that's going to be the big goal, really, for the next 10 years. So in conclusion, our systems of care must innovate to meet future needs, and that's clear from all of the demographic data that we look at. ICT, information communication technologies will enable it to happen. But it's not just about technology. We need leadership, and I think you have this here in Finland, political and managerial leadership to want to do this. We need incentives in some cases to get things started and to persuade people to work in different ways. And we need new service ideas, and that's what we were working on today. We need things that meet a real societal or individual need and get them into the market, get people using them to see how effective they are. So I hope you found that helpful, and I hope you've taken a few ideas from it. And the only way you're going to know whether I was a good future ologist or not is to ask me again in 2027, I should say. So if you wish, I'll see if I can come back then. So thank you very much. Sure, if there are any immediate questions, I'm happy to. Yes.
Just a moment.
Normally I can speak. I saw a great idea recently at a conference, which was a microphone inside a soft toy, and you could just throw it across the room. Have you seen that? You just throw it around the room. It was really clever.
Okay, I have two questions.
Yeah.
That the first one is that when I studied cognitive science 85 in Carnegie Mellon, in this Watson narrative, I have not seen anything that wouldn't have talked that time there. Mm-hmm. And this is of course is also my students that they somehow think that there is nothing new. Mm-hmm. But my belief is that actually we live at the edge of very big innovative revolution. Mm-hmm. And Watson is part of this. It means really that artificial intelligence is coming something true. Mm. But my question is that what is your vision? Why? What is the difference between 84 and 2015? Why this situation or the whole ball game has changed so much?
Mm-hmm. You want me to answer that now?
Yes.
Gosh, that's very difficult. So what has changed? Well, I'd say the technology has advanced rapidly in terms of the power available to do this in a way that we couldn't have really imagined it 30 years ago. I think we've got the processing power, we've got the mobility. The mobile platform, I think, allows us to reach more people with it. And I think, in a way, we've also got more societal needs to fix now than we had then. I think a lot of the challenges that we are faced with now, require technological approaches. The actual idea of artificial intelligence, you're right, it's not a new thing by any means. But what we found is that when people start thinking about what they want to do and start thinking about what artificial intelligence might offer them, it basically changes the way they think. They start thinking in a new way about what's possible. I was involved in computer programming going all the way back to about 1973, I think I wrote my first program, 72, 73, in Fortran. And at that time, I was trying to write some very simple systems for translating French to English, for example. Not with the artificial intelligence, but I was trying to kind of, work with natural language then. And the actual ability to do something remarkably human-like would just seemed a long way away from what we were doing then. And I think where we're getting to now with these systems is they're starting to get to the point where the interactions with them are much more natural. So we're not sitting at a keyboard any longer. We're actually talking to systems. We are using mobile devices to interact with them. And I think that's also a factor in all of this. It's really beginning to make it happen. But going back to the point I made a moment ago, I think people are ready to have this discussion now about, how do we use technology? And a lot of the problems they're trying to solve don't require artificial intelligence. In fact, sometimes they go into projects where we kind of back off to, we don't need all that. We can do it in a much simpler way. Well, there are some areas where artificial intelligence will play a really interesting role. I guess from our point of view, we've also been experimenting in this domain for a long time. But the thing that's changed it for us is just the recognition that the world is receptive now. It's receptive at scale. And our chairman, Ginni Rometty, has basically concluded that the future of IBM is in this new way of working with computers. We've gone from the tabulating era to the program computing era to the cognitive or trained artificial intelligence era. And we see our future there rather than in a previous generation of technology. I think that's kind of the way we think about it.
Okay. Can I ask a second
question? Of course, yes.
Okay. The second question is that we have now a lot of new technical concepts like autonomy, for example, and which is
like what?
Autonomy.
Yes.
Autonomy, mm-hmm. which is related to these issues. And it has a lot of consequences, thinking, for example, changes in work life and mm-hmm. medicine and wherever. Mm-hmm. But my question is that what is your vision? How much this change requires technical artifact development? And how much it requires understanding people mm-hmm. and developing human organizations?
Mm-hmm. I think the two things go hand in hand. I mean, I think the issue with a lot of our chaos systems is that we basically put technology into them to try to improve them. But as someone has famously said, if you spend money on technology and put it into a bad chaos system, you just get a more expensive bad chaos system. That's kind of what happens with it. So have we really, for example, benefited greatly from electronic patient records? It's quite hard to find evidence that that's the case for many places. We've certainly got better record keeping than we used to have. We can find information faster. But have we really exploited what's in the patient record itself? And the reason that we haven't is because we've not changed the way that we interact with that patient record. It's still seen as a necessary process that the doctors and nurses have to go through to record everything. They're not really looking to it to help them make decisions a lot of the time. They're going back to their textbooks and to their own intellectual learning. So it's only when we start to change the roles and the responsibilities and the organization of care systems that we'll really get the benefit of these technologies. There have been a lot of trials, for example, of telemedicine and telehealth to see whether they are actually good things to spend money on. And what most of the trials have concluded is that you can certainly improve quality of care, but you can't reduce cost, which is quite odd when you think about it. You think being able to use monitoring and remote services would, because it reduces costs in other industries. And the reason is that we basically haven't changed the roles and responsibilities of the people. We've just said we're going to still have hospitals and still have clinics, and we're still going to have all these people with uniforms on, even though a lot of the stuff could be done remotely. We're still going to have all these assets, so you're not actually reducing the size of the healthcare real estate to do that. I did find, two comments. I did find there's a new hospital in the United States called Mercy Virtual, which is the first truly virtual hospital where they have 300 clinicians working in it, but they have no beds and no patients. Everything they do is virtual. That's all they do. And that's kind of an interesting development. Also, the second comment is that a lot of countries like India, for example, where I was speaking with some people from India recently, they just have nothing. They just don't have the resources to offer most of the population access to good healthcare. So they need to use this kind of this way of communicating. They need to use what people have, and very often it's the mobile phone that they're working with. So I think in answer to your question, I think the evolution of care systems and the technology within them has to go hand in hand. You can't really separate them very easily. I think at least people now understand that technology is not just about throwing things into the system. They need to consider change and change management and the impact it has on people's jobs. And I think that's better understood.
So I guess we are now out of time, so maybe we can talk with you then later
of
after
course,
the presentation.
Yes, absolutely, so, yes, thank you.
So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.